Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, January 21st, 2006. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I welcome you to our weekly hour-long show. And those of you on the telephone conference call for LaRouche organizers, those of you participating live by Internet, we welcome your emails. And those on the phone, call us during the week. That's how we're doing things right now. But I especially welcome several guests. We have a couple off-site and a couple here in the studio with me because we are in an intense mobilization and things are shifting in the right direction. We're going to hear a lot about that. But as you know, the topic for this week was, which we've been advertising in advance, is the fact that the economic collapse has proceeded around the world, but in the United States, so severely that the deindustrialization of the major industrial concentrations in the Midwest and the East Coast, like Baltimore, is resulting in actual new disease syndromes and what you could call death zones. So I'm going to introduce the guests with us to discuss this, but I'll say right up front that we are going to begin with an update after I introduce the guests and some marching orders for all of you participating in on the situation around the nomination of Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court. We'll say more about that in a minute. But here in the studio, we have two people who have been involved in the team that put out the EIR feature study commissioned by Lyndon LaRouche on the case of Baltimore and disease. And that is, we welcome Anita Gallagher. Hi.
It's good to be here.
And Dr. Ned Rosinski. Hi, Ned.
Hi, how you doing?
And Ned is, and I have to say this, Anita was born and raised in Baltimore and has related to it over the decades since, besides being a close political associate and activist of Mr. LaRouche for many decades. And Ned Rosinski is still a resident and practicing physician in Maryland and a close associate of Lynn's. And off-site in Baltimore, we're glad to have with us Larry Freeman. Welcome, Larry.
Hello.
And I hope we have on now, or we will soon have from the LaRouche Youth Movement, Delonte Bess. Are you there, Delonte?
I'm here.
Oh, welcome. Oh. And it's true, Delonte. You were born and bred Baltimore, but you're speaking to us from Washington. Is that true?
No. I wasn't born in Baltimore.
Okay.
I'm actually born in Washington.
Okay.
And then I'm in Boston right now.
Oh, okay. And that just shows you how...
But he was in Prince George's County, Maryland, which is pretty bad.
Okay.
Yeah.
But Delonte will be...
I
want to tell everyone that you've also been involved in kicking off the new year in a week of action in Washington, D.C., right, around the time of the January 11th webcast by Mr. LaRouche. Is that the case?
That was right. We had about 100 or so young people, members of the LaRouche Youth Movement and other people who came down from other locations, organizing and just taking over the streets as we do. And then as well, not only just engage in a dialogue one-on-one with LaRouche, but then was able to sort of get in a dialogue with the U.S. Congress the preceding days after LaRouche's webcast. So it was really amazing. And then we came back here to Boston and had another type of week of action with one of the leading voice training specialists, I guess you can say, or maestros. You can say this guy by the name of Maestro Briano. So we're doing musical work after the week of action we had in Washington, D.C. last week.
Oh, that's great. Well, we want to get back to that throughout the hour to hear more, especially on Congress and also on the whole cultural front you're describing. But I have something special to begin this show with. I mentioned that about the nomination of Samuel Alito, and that is the following, that we're now going to hear in a few seconds a one-minute ad that's been prepared by the LaRouche Youth Movement to start running in Washington, D.C. radio on Monday, January 23rd. And right after that ad, we're going to hear from Anita Gallagher, who will tell you what the latest is in this battle over Samuel Alito, what's involved, who's doing what, where it stands. And I just I don't want to introduce too much, but just point out that just a few hours ago, we had something very typical. Bush gave his weekly radio show and said the economy is doing great. Everything is great. Healthcare in particular is just doing great. Cheney said the same thing this week. Now, that's, you could say that's just normal idiocy, but that's the point. It isn't. With the economic collapse in the state it's in, the financial networks behind this idiocy are the ones behind Samuel Alito, behind the idea of putting in the modern form of what put in Hitler. These networks, they may not use rhetoric like the will to power or the state über alles, but they through the networks are speaking in terms of the unitary executive, preemptive war, this kind of thing. And this is what Mr. LaRouche went through to warn people about January 11th at the webcast. And without further ado, though, just listen to this ad, and then Anita Gallagher will fill us in. So go right ahead with the ad.
The following is paid for by Lyndon LaRouche Peck.
Here's Lyndon LaRouche commenting on the Sam Alito nomination.
Sam Alito, the man's a liar. He's a member of the Federalist Society, which now controls four of the nine justices of the Supreme Court. And a fifth member is about to be confirmed. Carl Schmitt lived in this country and influenced the formation of the Federalist Society. Carl Schmitt crafted the Adolf Hitler administration. And you would have five out of nine Supreme Court justices prepared to endorse a fascist government in the United States. And you have senators who should have more guts who are waffling or being weak in dealing with this fact. There is no honest debate about bringing Adolf Hitler and his tradition into the government of the United States.
That was the ad. Anita, take it away. What do you think? Can we stop? And what should people do? What do they need to know? What are you telling people?
Well, Senator Dick Durbin gave a press conference yesterday, and he said that the terrain has definitely shifted, and he is amazed at the depth of feeling of some of his colleagues. He said that there are 45 Democrats, if they count that the independent of Vermont, Jeffords, will vote for them, and that would be enough to filibuster. So the filibuster possibility was raised by Dick Durbin, and there are eight Democrats who have already announced that they are against Alito. Senator Leahy, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, gave a long press conference where he pointed out that Alito was vetted for his nomination in Vice President Dick Cheney's office with Karl Rove and Louis Libby present on May 5, 2005.
Wow.
Senator Durkin is against Alito, and three so-called centrist Democrats have said they will vote against him: Senator Baucus of Montana, Senator Wyden of Oregon, Senator Salazar of Colorado, Senator Mikulski of Baltimore, and Senator Kennedy and Senator Harkin of Iowa. So this is very much a pitch battle. People are becoming very active. There's a lot of motion on the ground. The ground is definitely ahead of the Senate Democrats, because the people that we are in contact with around the country understand that this is fascism, it's dictatorship, they have the smell, they're very disappointed that the senators have not done more, and they want Alito stopped. So I think the battle is really open, and that it can go our way if people really pour it on. We know that the Senate Judiciary Committee will vote on Tuesday. But beyond that, we know what the Republicans would like to do, which is rush to a vote. But whether that is going to happen, we can definitely impact, and I think we can stop it.
That's great. I know you've been involved in helping coordinate a whole national phone bank mobilization. It's going to go on tomorrow. I know it's been going on every day, but on Sunday. And so when you say pour it on, people can get...
I think it would be very important if all of our listeners mobilize their entire networks to call the senators and make clear to them that it is not enough to even simply vote against Alito, but they have to take whatever actions, open whatever flanks, and initiate whatever bold moves they can in order to stop this, because we don't want to be in a position where we say, well, Hitler got control of the Supreme Court, but I voted against it.
Okay.
We want to win.
Thanks. And I'll throw in here that I understand that the LaRouche PAC has been able to print close to 500,000 so far of the what was called Children of Satan 4 that has a description of these networks in it. And 170-some thousand of the January 11th webcast by Lynn, who sounded the trumpet. Is that right?
Yes, that is. And that is being shipped by the fastest means possible all over the country to Democratic activists. It's going out in the streets. It's saturated Washington. Our listeners who want some can call in and ask for it. Plus, it's on the LaRouche PAC website, www.larouchepac.com. There's a PDF version that can be downloaded as a leaflet, and the pamphlets are on, and the ad is also on that you just heard and is available to be listened to.
Okay, great. Well, we can return to that throughout the show. And Delonte, as I said, we'll want to hear this picture from the streets of Washington. But what I'll do is we can open up the discussion of Baltimore because, of course, this whole study that's been done in the EIR that's commissioned by LaRouche and ongoing work Ned Rosinsky can talk about makes the point that you're going to have you already have collapse. You're going to go into accelerated collapse and death if we don't turn this thing around and have an emergency measures to rebuild the economy. So, Ned, why don't you, if you kick things off, you were briefing Lynn a year ago on the medical situation as you saw it and sort of started this whole thing.
Well, I can talk about that, but I think before I do, I'd like to just give the listeners an idea of an overview of what's been going on in Baltimore over the past several generations. Because I can talk about how Baltimore is in shambles, and I can talk about how it's broken as a city and doesn't function as a city. But I think we need to understand how that happened in order to figure out what to do about it. So I would want, maybe I'd ask Anita to just basically review a little bit of that.
Well, one thing is Larry was going to say something about the deindustrialization
in terms of the
actual going from how many hundreds of thousands of manufacturing workers down to nothing. Okay, great. Do you want to go ahead, Larry?
Well, sure. I mean, we've seen this. I've seen this firsthand for the last three decades when I moved to Baltimore in 1973, although the plans really worked out way before then. And essentially what we have seen in Baltimore is a typified probably situation in many cities, but essentially the post-industrial society kills. And that's what we now, some of Ned's work, we now have that conclusively proven. The effects of destroying the infrastructure, destroying the manufacturing base, lowering the wage level, destroying housing, denying people the basic necessities of life, actually has led to a substantial abnormal death rate. I mean, Baltimore, coming out of the World War II, was one of the great industrial cities in the United States. And at one point, Sparrow's Point, in the 1950s, employed about 35,000 workers.
You're talking about Bethlehem Steel.
I'm sorry,
for
Bethlehem
those.
Steel at Sparrow's Point, and that was the largest steel complex in the world. And with the advent of the post-industrial society, it began to wind down. Though even as late as the 1960s, late 1960s, were almost 30,000 workers, industrial workers, at this giant complex at Sparrow's Point, Maryland. And then the shift in policy became very dramatic. And the policy was, from the top down, we don't want industry anymore in this country. And the first attack was on the steel industry, among many. And we saw, year by year, the collapse of this great industrial center. So Sparrow's Point, even as late as 1969, with about 30,000 workers, now has probably about 2,000 to 2,500 workers total. At that time, in the 50s and 60s, around Sparrow's Point, there was a whole complex of industrial businesses, some small, some large, Domino Sugar, American Smelting, General Motors had a plant, Bruning Highway at one point, which employed up to 7,500 workers. and many little specialty shops where industrial workers would be preparing various parts of needed products that made this whole machinery work. And people got, at that time, fairly decent wages, wages that were represented an increase in their standard of living, and they were able to buy houses for the first time, own houses in Dundalk and Turner Station, but also in West Baltimore, Edmondson Village. They owned their own homes. They were able to send their kids to college. And they performed an industrial productive task, and they were rewarded for it with the life that this country used to represent, the good life that at least we had up to the Kennedy period of John F. Kennedy. And you had communities developing and people growing and families functioning as families. And that now is completely gone. It's been eliminated. It's been wiped out. It doesn't, you can't find it. And the city now has no more industrial workers. We've gone just in the last 30 years from about 110,000, 120,000 down to about 15,000 to 16,000 manufacturing workers in the city of Baltimore just in the last 30 years. And you've seen that the Sparrows Point is gone. General Motors has been shut down. Domino Sugar is gone. All the other plants are gone. And the whole city has been transformed into this fantasy, this utopian fantasy called the post-industrial society. So you have very nice restaurants and hotels. When I moved here, there were two major hotels. Now it's about 100. And this idea of a service economy without any quality of industrial manufacturing base to it has led to lowering the standard of living of the whole city, except for those people who are making paper profits in the so-called internet society. And as a result of that, wage levels have dropped. So the most people in the city of Baltimore do not earn a wage that can support a family. 90% of jobs are in the service sector, and the majority of those are healthcare-related jobs, but healthcare-related jobs that pay very low. And what we found as we looked at this closer is there's entire sections of Baltimore City which are death zones. As one city resident, teacher, a friend of ours who we interviewed in the report, called them, and he was absolutely correct. And I drove these areas myself and with others, and there's no one there except for young African-American males walking around. There's no jobs for them. There's no families. There's no people. Except some people actually live in burnt-out housing because they have nowhere else to go. So essentially, from the top, we've carried out this policy of this post-industrial society, and it has literally destroyed one of the great blue-collar manufacturing cities on the East Coast. Now, Mr. LaRouche has a very clear idea of how to rebuild it, but I think we can use this to make clear to people that the policies of the last 3 to 4 decades have been a failure. Have been a failure that conclusively can be proven by the increase in the death rate as a result of these policies.
Well, let me ask, Anita, you were also, I mean, you pointed out more about this, the underside of the fantasy where speculators came in and set up these inner harbor. And do you want to add more on that right now or anything like that?
Well, I think Baltimore has certain lessons that every city could take to heart. For example, since these real estate developments began in the 1950s and through the present, spending on these sorts of redevelopment efforts has increased by 400%. And during that entire period, spending on education and social welfare has decreased by 25%. There is no hotel of the type that Larry described for which the city did not pay at least 30% of the construction costs.
So this is a giveaway to Marriott or something.
Exactly. Some of these hotels have never paid it back. Some of the contracts have a clause that they have to make a certain amount of money before they have to pay anything back. The two biggest boondoggles of all are the two stadia, the Orioles at Camden Park and the Ravens Stadium. These sound very good on paper. We hear that the Orioles Stadium brings back $7 million a year in revenue that Baltimore would have never had, but they don't mention that it costs $17 million. to the city. And the Ravens Stadium is even worse of a deal that makes $1.4 million a year but costs the city $18 million. So these are bleeding the city, literally, of money, along with the maintenance of the Inner Harbor. And the point of these kinds of tourist venues is that you are also always having to add something new and preposterous, like the balloon, which went up and couldn't be gotten back down.
No.
And this takes even more money. And meanwhile, we've seen things like the basic railroad infrastructure atrophy to the point where in 2001 there was a five-day fire that could have killed hundreds of people right in the center of Baltimore, and which occurred basically because the tunnel was 106 years old. We see a decrepit school plant. We see tremendous poverty in the Baltimore City schools, and these jobs in these tourist meccas are paying below poverty level wages. There are only three jobs in these tourist industries which pay even above poverty level: cook, tour guide, and a security person. Otherwise, people are making $6, $7, $8 an hour. And in the other service jobs in the health industry, people are making $10 or $11 an hour. But they're at the poverty level, or they are below what SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, has estimated to be a necessary wage of $17.43 an hour. So this is 90% of the people in Baltimore are making these kind of wages. So it's a very bad situation, and the money of the city, instead of going into high-paying industrial jobs, is going into prop up these kinds of boondoggles.
Right. Well, Ned may want to jump in or with this too, but one thing you've all brought out is the what's also part of this is the imprisonment, the you know, with no jobs, as Larry was just talking about, or low wage jobs, the lack of families, the rate of imprisonment of African American young males is maybe one of the highest in the nation, right?
56% of African-American males between 20 and 40 are under the supervision of the correction system, and about 20% are actually in jail or prison at any one time. There is a turnover of largely African-American prisoners who are going back into Baltimore, back into certain neighborhoods, which are called death zones. 10,000 a year who are coming out of prisons and who are bringing back diseases that they've been exposed to into areas of intense poverty. And I know that Dr. Rosinski can tell us that Lyndon LaRouche has been attuned to the relationship between disease and poverty for a very long time, even going back to the 1985 studies in Belgrade, Florida, of the relationship of TB and AIDS and poverty in that area. So we have that kind of breeding ground, particularly in certain parts of Baltimore, which were actually mapped in the article in the Executive Intelligence Review.
Okay, thanks. So, Ned, do you have what do you say?
Well, first of all, I want to pick up on a couple of things Larry was saying, which is has to do with the intransigence of poverty in pockets of Baltimore. In my experience, nearly 20 years, things have only gotten worse. There is a pessimistic kind of culture, a culture of pessimism where people feel like things can never get better. But it's very instructive to look back a little further to the 60s, and I don't know if Larry mentioned it, but the majority of those workers in the steel plants were African American.
Mm-hmm.
They owned homes. They had reasonable neighborhoods. The kids went to school. And it functioned. There was a functional society there. And what ripped it apart was the deindustrialization policy, which is motivated on maybe on some level, certainly by greed, which is transplanting these plants overseas where you can have slave labor do the job and produce more cheaply. There are certainly other motivations involved, too, having to do with control of the city. But what we have is, because that was ripped out of the city, the population was left to flounder and fend for itself, you ended up with a culture of pessimism, And there are people who are trying to help, and there have always been people trying to help. They look at this and they can't stand it, and they say, I have to do something. And I would call them – and they try to do something narrowly, like help the homeless, find people shelter, you know, bring people in out of the cold, find them a doctor to cure some kind of horrible infection they may have picked up because they had no medical care, get some kids into foster care when the parents have abandoned them, that kind of stuff. But I'll tell you, these do-gooders who have a narrow focus, in the end, they're not really do-gooders because they don't do any good. Because you can't fix this problem by looking at one small piece of it. And the main problem that we have with these do-gooders is they only look at one small piece. The understanding of a problem, as far as I'm concerned, can only be measured by the power of the that it imparts to the person who tries to change it. And if your understanding of a situation doesn't produce a power to change it, so your actions are impotent, then it means that your understanding is lacking, and you have to improve your understanding. And that's basically the history of past attempts to fix this problem. Now, having worked in the area as a psychiatrist, I deal with sometimes people individually. I put together individual stories. How did person X end up in this situation? And I have to look through the layers of collapse, successive layers of collapse of individual lives, to be able to formulate a plan for helping. And invariably what I find is that there are multiple factors that are interacting to that result in people being literally destroyed. I'm talking about, you know, total life destroyed. Frequently it will begin with a job loss. The breadwinner of the house will lose a job, maybe a job that wasn't paying very much anyway. That causes a crisis in the family. There's no income. They can't pay rent. They can't pay the mortgage. They have to abandon the home after a while and get evicted. And again, every story is different, but this is a typical kind of story. They get evicted, they're homeless, and maybe some of them can live with one of the parents of one of the couple or something, and the other people can't. The family gets fragmented. The kids are stressed out, and the breadwinner may get desperate, starts feeling stressed personally and psychologically, and may resort to self-medicating with some cocaine or marijuana, heroin, or alcohol or something. That only makes the situation worse. These short-term efforts to dull the pain only make it worse. Then the person may not have the money to do that. Of course, they're unemployed. How are they going to pay for cocaine, which is expensive? So they start committing minor crimes, shoplifting, then breaking and entering, then robbery with confrontation with a weapon, eventually get caught, get put in jail, further psychological stress, further disruption of the family, maybe a divorce, mother starts going out with other guys. These are not blood relative to the kids. The kids are then subject to possible abuse. On and on and on. These stories just keep going like a snowball going downhill, faster and faster. The root cause of it, well, we've already talked about the root cause of it. It's a cultural change, a deindustrialization, lack of productive employment, and a feeling of being productive by the breadwinners and the adults of society. But as the snowball goes downhill, further things tend to happen. The kids are dislocated. They don't have parental models. They hang out in the streets. The parents are on drugs. That means the schools become chaotic. The majority of kids in the schools are not paying any attention to what's going on. They're not even there most of the time. The teachers get exhausted. And before you know it, the schools are not teaching anything. The kids are all dropping out. And as a result of this kind of a profile, the situation becomes self-perpetuating. It's almost as if the country that was a colony is now patrolling itself, and the colonial country doesn't have to even lift a finger. The slave has perpetuated the slavery from the master, and the master doesn't have to lift a finger.
Ned, hold that. I want you to resume with that. We have at the half point of the show, we make a few announcements, and then we continue right away. And people know this is January 21st, 2006, but it's the LaRouche Show. We're from 3 to 4 p.m. on every Saturday, weekly, in the afternoon, on the internet site of our publisher, EIR News Service, which is www.larouchepub.com, LaRouchePub.com. And I encourage you to call at any time to connect, to get literature. You can do that on the site, of course. But here is a toll-free number inside the United States, 1-888-347-3258. That's 1-888-347-3258. On January 28th, we will welcome our host, who is here once in a while, Michelle Steinberg, and other guests from 3 to 4 in the afternoon. And I just say one more thing, and we're going to return to Ned Rosinsky's report on Baltimore and also to politically what we're doing, what the latest is in the LaRouche effort. But Cyril in St. Louis, you are 95 today, and we all send you our best respects. Okay, Ned.
Having kind of just described the way in which some of these factors can interact, substance abuse can interact with psychological collapse, making it worse, and can interact with family disruptions. Family disruption can then go back and make people feel like using substances. So these are interacting factors which drive a collapse kind of process. Having witnessed this over years, it occurred to me that, and having seen death rates actually in areas that I was familiar with get worse, it occurred to me that maybe we should do a study of Baltimore, a little bit different than the usual kinds of studies that are done, which measure overall death rates and overall lifespans and death rates from different kinds of diseases and African-American versus white death rates, that kind of thing. And I thought maybe what would be good would be to at least statistically validate the observation that I had made working in some of the most impoverished areas, that they actually are getting worse, and that despite the overall statistics for the country and for Maryland that show that things are not getting too bad or maybe getting a little bit better overall, that in some areas things actually are getting quite worse, quite a bit worse. And one thing that suggested this to me was that there have been some widely published income studies for the country as a whole that show that the overall income is not doing too badly, maybe increasing a little bit, decreasing a little bit, but about stable. However, when you divide the country into high income and low income, and particularly the upper 20% versus lower 80%, that the reason that the average is doing not too badly is because the upper 20% is skyrocketing up, whereas the lower 80% is decreasing. And I was thinking maybe that's going on in Baltimore, and maybe we should do a fine-tuned study of the city, looking at the smallest geographical areas we can in order to be able to hone in on areas of extreme poverty and see if we can look at death statistics and disease statistics and just be able to say for sure what my subjective impression had been for years. So that's what I started doing. And unfortunately, all the statistics are not – the statistics are not what you would always want them to be, but there are small area statistics that are on the basis of census tracts. The 10-year federal census counts people on the basis of census tracts, and these tracts are actually quite small, on the range of several hundred to several thousand people. And Baltimore is divided into approximately 200 of those tracts. So I thought, okay, why don't we just look at each tract? And some of those tracts are bound to be impoverished areas, and some of those tracts are bound to be higher income areas, if not wealthy, certainly higher income. And we could do a comparison of the health statistics between those tracts and see whether there is actually a large discrepancy and how big that discrepancy is, and if that discrepancy is getting worse over time. So I initially started looking at census tracts, trying to pick out which were the ones in poverty. And when I got the data from the U.S. Census, which is all public data over the Internet, you could see that there's actually a more or less a continuum. Very poor tracks that are not quite so poor, tracks with more of a higher income, and everything in between. And so it occurred to me, why don't we look at this whole thing as a continuum and compare the poorer tracks to the higher income tracks, but also look at the ones in between and do a comprehensive study of the entire city. So that's what I ended up doing. I ended up doing all of the tracks. I could tell from the census what the population was for each tract. I could also tell from the census what the age distribution of that population is. And based on the age distribution of the population, I could calculate the expected number of deaths per year for that tract. Because there are national figures that say for a 21-year-old or a 35-year-old, what's the likelihood of dying in the next year, 65-year-old and so on. So the first part of the study I did was to try to estimate how many people should be dying in these different tracts, and then correlate that with how many people actually did die. And that information is also available from the state and the city, the health departments. And what I found was a result that I kind of had anticipated, but there it was. Happy to see that it was true, but unhappy to see the reality. was that the tracts that had the highest income had actually a below-average death rate compared to what you'd expect from that population with its age structure, whereas the tracts that were had the highest poverty had between a 2 and 4 times expected death rate.
Right. Well, one thing is let me just throw in an email here, and then Delonte and Larry, you know, may have something to say about it too. But to Ned, this is from Eugene. And Eugene is asking, I'll just read it directly, what is the level of cognition or recognition of people in Baltimore to this? Do they know why the demise of Baltimore is happening? Are they apathetic? Are they angry? Are they mobilizable? I'll just throw that out to you.
Well, on one level, a lot of people I talk to living in Baltimore, Baltimore residents, have some awareness that Baltimore once was a manufacturing city and had a fairly high standard of living relative to the skill levels that were available at the time that people were participating in, and that there was a much better lifestyle, so to speak, for families in that period. They also recognize that Baltimore has been, that policy of manufacturing has been whittled away, and that there is now clearly the policy for Baltimore is this service economy. And it's very, very obvious. I mean, right downtown, you have 2 Coliseums, 2 stadiums that Anita mentioned, and a few blocks away is the Inner Harbor, and around that, a bunch of very high-classy hotels, and some new townhouses modeled on the paper shacks from Loudoun County. And then the further away you go, you see where the slave quarters are in the poverty of the city. So there is an awareness that the city was transformed. What people don't understand is the cause of it, that it was an intentional policy to destroy the manufacturing capability of the city. And then, of course, the situation that Ned spoke about, which is the extreme pessimism that you can't do anything about it. And this, of course, what we're dealing with all the time on the question of stopping Judge Alito from going to the Supreme Court or impeaching Cheney. There's a very, very deep pessimism in the population that you can change anything, even if they're aware of how bad it is. On the other side, the policy planners, the Greater Baltimore Committee, the people who put Mayor Schaefer in office, Mayor Schmoke, all the politicians in the city, they think that manufacturing is over, that we don't need it, that we'll never bring back the industry. We don't have the industry now, and we don't need the industry now, and there will never be, quote, smokestacks again in Baltimore, that we're far better off having a service economy, and that this is the way of the future. And therefore, they agree with the policy, and they find nothing objectionable about the policy. So that's from the top, coming down from the financial interests through the politicians. But in either looking at both sides, it's only really our movement that understands why this happened and intends to do something about it.
Well, let me ask right here for Delonte, because I presume you've been eyeball to eyeball on this on Capitol Hill, on the streets of Washington, New England, and so forth. Are you there, Delonte?
I'm here.
Do you want to throw in something about this, rolling back this pessimism or waking people up?
Yeah, I mean, this is extremely grim to a real situation that we've been able to sort of organize the people out in the population, and even particularly the education of Congress, to be able to sort of get a real live, I could even say, transformation of this sort of post-industrial process, which really doesn't exist completely in everyone's mind. So showing them something like this Baltimore report is extremely provocative in bringing up the kind of subjects of economics, and then on top of that, bringing in what LaRouche is developing as a solution for that. Just to hark back on what Larry and Ned were saying, it's true that, I mean, you know, you find this in the population. They know, even in Baltimore, where you're talking about Baltimore, Detroit, or here in the Massachusetts area, they know that their area used to be highly industrial. That, I mean, you'll find people whose families used to work in the labor field, in the unions, and whatnot. They don't know. They don't have any real sense of what the causes of that. And it's hard for them because the question of what to do as a solution doesn't exist until we really implement some sort of serious organizing process in that area. So you get a real excitement that you see the LaRouche youth movement out on the street organizing around economic projects and the question of real cultural development. And I think what was interesting, if we go back to what LaRouche brought up in his webcast, when this guy Ted Smith, who's I guess from Baltimore himself, asked about what to do about the pessimism in the Baltimore situation or anywhere around these regions like Baltimore or the lower pits of Detroit and whatnot. And LaRouche simply just brought out this question of music, right, choral work. And being here for this past week, I'm just finishing up a week, as I was telling you earlier, of just an intense social process around the development of the human singing voice, real classical music. And, I mean, the fact that LaRouche brought this up as a key to sort of integrating some sort of real social process within these demoralized areas like Baltimore is really, really crucial. Now, the way this happens is interesting because if you take a group of young people from demoralized young people from different regions of Baltimore at a very young age, and it's clear that you bring them into the kind of choral work that we're doing, which is investigating some of the classical principles and scientific principles of music and artistic composition. You get them in a situation where they have to figure out problems. You get them in a situation where they actually have to be critical in terms of each other. You're really looking at a certain process of nation state building. And I think when you look at someone like his mind, like Bach or Beethoven or someone like that, these guys were real nation-state builders. And this gentleman by the name of Maestro Briano, who's come here for this week, and he flew all the way from Mexico, has been able to do that. He's brought, and we've strung in people from off the street, from anywhere around Massachusetts, or I could say the same thing what we did in Washington, D.C., and seeing how this inspires people to do the kind of work that is necessary for them to change. I mean, that's on the cultural aspect as a way of really increasing the level of inspiration and motivation for the young people in Baltimore or Detroit or, South Central Los Angeles or whatnot. Coupled with the kind of ideas that we have to have that LaRouche is raising on this question of economics. So it's a tough but and challenging endeavor, but it can definitely happen. I'm witnessing it right now, being here in Boston, where we have about 50 or so young people who've never worked in this kind of atmosphere doing this core work. And I think we can do the same thing for these general regions as we're doing in Detroit, but also with Baltimore as well.
Great. Well, anyone, Ned, or do you want to? Do you want to say more on both the medical? Anything on the medical side, or what you and LaRouche have talked about
I'd like to just say a few things following up on Oosterlund.
And by the way, we still have over 15 minutes. If someone wants to send another email, we'll take it today, or you can send it in during the week. Go ahead.
The more you understand how this process of collapse works. Of which I was just giving a few of these interacting factors before, the more you can understand how to reverse it. People are always looking for a solution to this kind of problem when they're being subjected to these horrible conditions. And the problem that the reason for the pessimism is because none of the proposed solutions that you read in the media, the major media, have any hope of helping. And any attempts that they have made to do anything on their own have resulted in failure because the system is very tight in terms of this control in terms of these interacting factors, the poverty, the incarcerations, the schools are terrible, the healthcare availability. It appears to be a hopeless situation. That doesn't mean there's no fight or desire to change. It just means that people are looking around and saying that they don't see any handles to pull to change things. And what's essential is to pull back and get a broader overview of how this entire process is working now in terms of tax policy slave labor standards overseas, where a lot of the goods are being manufactured, how this fits in, this deindustrialization thing fits in financially for people with power. So you understand that. And also historically looking back and saying, hey, things are not always this way. Things used to be different. This is imposed. And they don't have to be this way. Then at that point, the only thing standing between you and actually doing something potent to actually change it is your own fears of getting out there and doing something. And that is a real issue, because when you've been mistreated and abused since childhood, it's possible for a lot of people to develop what you would call a low self-esteem and a feeling of powerlessness. And that inhibits and can inhibit people from taking an action. When you're in that kind of situation, the only way you can take an action is when you actually see clearly the light at the end of the tunnel, like Martin Luther King would start a mobilization. People would say, hey, I can see how this is going to work. I'm going to join the march. Because I understand now how this is going to work. And what we have to do is show people there is light at the end of the tunnel. That the people who are pulling the strings are a tiny minority, making all this money and having all this power. And they just basically depend on the sluggishness of the population and the low self-esteem of people who have been beaten down. And I'm not just talking about African Americans. I'm talking about the entire lower 80% of the population. And also some of the upper 20% too, because they are being beaten down in terms of their narrow self-interests, their fear of losing everything if things go wrong. They maybe know more than other people how shaky this whole system is, because they're speculating on the profits, on making profits, and they can see quite well what's going on. So they're afraid to do anything because they're terrified. If they do the wrong thing, everything will fall apart. So in that kind of a situation, you come in with a plan, you explain to people what's going on, and people start responding. And so I just want to emphasize that this can be reversed. It can spiral up just like it spirals down. If as long as you give people a vision of what works and a demonstration. And that's how this Judge Alito thing is going to play out. You take on Bush in his most preposterous kinds of policies and initiatives, show the population how ridiculous it is, and then show that there are people willing to fight it, like some members of Congress have suddenly stood up and started fighting. That's what mobilizes people.
Well, let me ask you, we have 10 minutes left, and any of you can pipe up. That's the deal here. But I turn to Anita in case, who both was involved in this particular work on Baltimore that's published or ongoing work. But Anita, you've talked to a lot of people in the last few days when LaRouche said a lot of the congressmen and the senators I said last week they ate too much fruitcake over the holidays, and they came back and they weren't standing up to Alito. They weren't standing up to anything. They were powder puffs.
Well, fruitcake will do that.
Yeah, right. But they have changed. You've been talking to a lot of people in other states around the country. So picking up on what Delonte and Ned were saying, what do you think are people, or what do you find brings it home for people that they can fight? It's not a given that the thing is lost, and we're going to force backbone into Senate. What do you think?
Well, thinking about Baltimore reminds me of what Lyndon LaRouche said about his family, by way of all of our families, and explaining that there's a kind of reservoir of Republican understanding in the United States that we can dwell on, even if there are elements which are not so hot. As LaRouche ridiculed his own relationship to the Bush family via the family tree. That's what I think of in terms of Baltimore, because the majority of people there do understand, as Ned said, that it was once a wonderful powerhouse of production, and it produced a certain kind of people who thought that they were worthwhile people and that they were doing good on earth. And I think that is a source of strength to act for the future. And I think otherwise that the sense that the people can move a situation because sometimes situations take very little to move. And I think we have come a long way since we have started this mobilization to stop Alito. And there is a very direct connection to the Baltimore situation, which LaRouche made in his webcast address when he talked about the need to reconstruct Louisiana and the fact that Congress had appropriated the money, but none of it had been spent. And how would you ever address that if the Supreme Court is run by five people on the Federalist Society? That is, if there are five fascists on the Supreme Court, what city is going to get rebuilt? And that's what we need to get people the idea of. I think there are issues of regime change. Some things are just too much to bear. And I think Alito and this Cheney overreaction is one of them that sort of catalyzes anger in people, which is a good wellspring to act. The fact that the Justice Department, under the direction of Cheney, came out with a 42-page memo claiming that the president does have the right to do anything in an emergency situation.
Yeah, maybe you could draw that out a little. It was just 2 days ago, right, Anita?
Yes.
Alberto Gonzalez, or who is it?
Yes, a DOJ report in response to the criticism of the NSA spying and in response to a Congressional Research Service report that, in fact, not only had the Bush administration broken the FISA law with the spying, but they had been breaking the National Security Act law since 1947 by not fully briefing everybody on the Intelligence Committee. So the response of the madman was to say, yes, we didn't, and we affirm once again we don't have to. The president can do whatever he likes. He makes the law, which is exactly the phrase of Carl Schmitt, as we point out in the Children of Satan 4 pamphlet. So I think these kinds of things where people have a clear sense they're not going to back down, battle has been joined, we're fighting for our right to do good as we understand good that from the best traditions in our family, in our cities, in our locations, and that these people are the obstacle, I think people are ready for this kind of fight.
One thing, let me just throw in one update here, because those listening and participating to our show last week on the 14th knew it was the day before the election in Chile, where there was the same, there was a kind of Alito candidate, that is a Carl Schmitt, a Hitler type running for office, and was defeated by on the 15th in Chile for the presidential race by Michelle Bachelet, who was a woman who's herself and her mother experienced torture at the hands of the Pinochet dictatorship. And Michelle Bachelet will now be inaugurated as the president. And the issue is what's going to happen to the economy in the future. But the expose, Anita referred to the Federalist Society, the expose in the Children of Satan 4 and the financial networks behind Hitler and behind this kind of thing today were cross-fired, I think, a lot by the LaRouche Youth Movement in South America, all over Chile, and helped in this election process. So the issue of small forces making a huge difference, I think, could never be more more pressing than right now. And on that matter, Delonte, you may want to say something else in the concluding minutes, but is it the case that in the week of action in Washington, when around January 12th, you were involved in lobbying on Capitol Hill with some of the trade union leaders who, and other state representatives who came from around the country? Is that the case? Could you say something about it?
That's correct. Yeah, we made the point clear. Along, again, organizing around this question of what we had with the Baltimore situation, or the Baltimore report. But we made it clear, even to the congressmen, as we were organizing with the labor leaders, the union leaders, that these congressmen had these sort of mechanical, I guess, procedures to be able to try to figure out how to fix the economy. And we had to really make the point that, one, if we don't stop this appointment of Samuel Alito and dump Cheney and this whole fascist cabal, none of these actual mechanistic sort of procedures are going to actually come forward to working. And you had a whole real good process that went on amongst the union leaders and the youth movement, and just being real tough on this issue of how free trade in the last 30 years, as Larry and Ned have laid it out, has really just dismantled the whole physical economic process of this country. But what we were mainly focusing on is really trying to animate this seriously in the minds of the individuals of Congress. And you had a real shift, I guess you can say, right after Wednesday, LaRouche's webcast, where the fight really went just head on forward with the Alito stuff, because that's really when the fight began, with the Alito stuff and also with this question of economics. And the more we continue to go down there and organize around this issue in the preceding days, and I guess we're going to be headed back, I guess about 100 or so young or more people going back after the 31st, after Bush's, quote-unquote, State of the Union, we'll be making this issue of educating the Congress on economic, LaRouche's economics, just clear. And what people are seeing now, I think the people we're recruiting around this youth movement is that the identity of the individual has of our generation has to particularly be centered around educating the leadership of the country. And this is the sort of thing that's sort of going through the minds of the people who we're bringing down to Washington, D.C., and the people here that are already organizing full-time, the leaders of the leaders. So.
Marcia?
Yes, go right ahead, Larry.
If I may say one thing, is just to internationalize this a bit. I mean, one thing that is, I think, relevant for people to think about is the what we were able to identify in Baltimore is a number of different conditions operating, interacting with each other that produced this dynamic that leads to this increase 2 to 4 times above the average, above the normal death rate in the worst parts of the city. This is very relevant to the whole discussion of aid in sub-Saharan Africa, in fact, which many people also ignore, Africans and others discussing Africa, that the actual spread of AIDS now, which is proceeding at a very accelerated rate, reaching tens of millions of people throughout sub-Saharan Africa, is generated by a similar condition where you have the effects of a number of different processes at work in sub-Saharan Africa, such as poor health care, such as poor drinking water, such as extreme poverty, such as a lack of education, and many other conditions which have produced an environment of which the disease AIDS and other diseases are spreading and interacting with each other. And sometimes people reduce this down to a question of sexual promiscuity or some other single issue. But I think the work we did in Baltimore is directly relevant. It's not exactly the same conditions, but to a method of looking at the situation in Africa and in other parts of the world. And, of course, Mr. LaRouche did look at this question back in the 1970s. Now, it was only about 30 years ago before AIDS was discovered, and he actually forecast that a new deadly disease would erupt in the areas of the world of extreme poverty, which had been destroyed by the International Monetary Fund. And then, of course, within less than a decade, the HIV-AIDS syndrome was so-called discovered. So that there's a lawful process that we know about, we can discuss, we can analyze, that produces this deteriorating quality of life, which results in an increased death rate in the United States and in other parts of the world, and therefore it can be stopped. It can be stopped by stopping these policies, and the policies towards Africa are most extreme conditions, the same policies we're seeing in America. In fact, we're seeing now the sub-Saharanization, if we can make up that word, of the lower portion of the lower 80% in the United States. And the people running are the same people. And then that's precisely why Alito has to be stopped, is that these are actual fascist Nazi policies that will kill and are killing. And I think, therefore, we can use the work we've done in Baltimore to expand and look at other sections of the world in a similar scientific manner of cause, and therefore we can deal with that cause once we look at it that way.
Well, Larry, this ends up being the close of the show today, and I think you've summed it up. This has been the LaRouche Show, January 21st, 2006, and I make sure and listen January 28th. Michelle Steinberg and guests will be discussing what happened during this week of creating the mobilization to stop Alito and the fascists and what this represents. And I thank everyone for participating today.
Thank
Anita
you.
Gallagher, Ned Rosinsky, Larry Freeman, Delonte Bess. And this is Marcia Mary Baker. We're signing off, and every week, Saturday, 3 to 4, at www.larouchepub.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.